Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Hans Christensen, Director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists in Washington, D.C. Hans is a frequent advisor to the news media on the status of nuclear forces and policy. He is a co-author of the bi-monthly Nuclear Notebook column in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the World Nuclear Forces Overview in the CPRI Yearbook, two of the most widely used publications worldwide on the status of nuclear weapons. Prior to his current position, Hans Christensen was a consultant to the nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. from 2003 to 2005. Hans Christensen, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thanks very much.
Now, we're going to talk about issues that seem arcane today, but issues that are incredibly important and issues really that no one talks about anymore, but that hang overhead, over our head like the sword of Damocles. I don't know how you feel about this. You must have feelings about it. But as I read the material you sent me, Hans, it's just... It's beyond belief what the Americans are up to. And I think what we should start with to bring people up to date is the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review.
Yeah.
What on earth is a Nuclear Posture Review, Hans?
Well, every American president since the end of the Cold War has gone through a Nuclear Posture Review in one way or the other. And it's basically a 6 to 12 month exercise where the entire administration dealing with this is going through, trying to figure out for the next 10, perhaps even 15, but certainly 10 years, what is going to be the nuclear posture, how many nuclear weapons, what's the reason we have them, what's our policy on their potential use, what kind of factories do we need to build, simulation facilities or weapon systems. It's basically sort of their grand plan, if you will, with recommendations for how to move forward. Of course, the U.S. Congress still has to approve all of these goodies that they want, and so that's another phase that comes after. But so we've just had this nuclear posture review of the Obama administration completed last year in April.
Well, did he write it? Who wrote it? Where on earth does this stuff come from?
Well, you know how it is. This is it's sort of a process where the administration, the White House, says, listen, guys, we need to figure out why we have these things. And then they send a sort of a terms of reference, if you will, or a little teaser over to the Department of Defense and ask the Office of the Secretary of Defense to get their guys working on some options for the president. And back comes this, this series of different opportunities he has to do a number of issues ranging from reductions of nuclear weapons to building new systems. And, you know, it's really a wide span. And then he has to pick from all of that. And out of that comes a document. The first two nuclear postures we had after the end of the Cold War, never reached the public, at least not in an official way. One, the first one of the Clinton administration in 1994, never really, actually never even produced a final document before the process was, essentially taken over by the military. And the second part was in the Bush administration's nuclear posture. We might remember that a good chunk of that was leaked in 2002, was leaked to the media, and caused an enormous international scandal because people could finally see what countries were in the crosshairs. And then we have the first one here, the Obama administration, which is really the first time ever they've had a nuclear posture view in an unclassified form where people can sort of dive in and, you know, ponder what it means and, you know, critique the policy based on an official document rather than rumors and what have you. So that's kind of a unique document in this sense.
Well, I'm interested, who or what are the major dynamics and forces behind the nuclear weapons policies? I, from my quite extensive reading, I guess, assume it's actually the Pentagon, top people, the top brass, but also behind them, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and the corporations who actually really run the Pentagon. Now, that sounds blasphemous, but from my reading and background knowledge, would you agree with that basically, Hans, or not?
No, I don't think it's just the military and the contractors running it, so to speak, but I'd certainly agree that they have an overwhelming influence on it. I mean, in the way the process runs is that you have also significant input from people that are in the National Security Council, in the State Department, even in the, you know, sort of the agencies that are not necessarily involved in production, if you will, and making money on the nuclear business. But it is predominantly an influence by the brass that is either involved in the nuclear weapons program, of course, or the targeteer, so to speak, the group of the culture within, for example, U.S. Strategic Command, which is the command that has responsibility for the strategic nuclear war plan. No one else really knows sort of the mathematics of how you get from the presidential guidance, if you will, his wish list for why we have nukes and who the enemies are. How do you translate that into nuclear weapons delivery systems and, you know, elaborate targeting strategies and war plans and what have you? That's really where you have those experts, so to speak, that very much seem to insist that they're the ones who know how to do that stuff.
Yes, it seems to me like they're really autonomous, and the president may want something or something else, but in fact, it's like a huge freight train with about three steam engines in front, and nothing stops it. And what I have to be a little personal here, Hans, having helped.
Yeah, it's an enormous machine with huge interests invested in it, of course.
Yeah.
And everybody has their pet project and the way they want to see it go. And the money,
you know, here's America on its last legs financially. Let's be frank, you know, double dip recession on about to come on, millions out of work. America doesn't make things anymore except make weapons of war and instruments of war and killing. I'm being a little simplistic. And I may offend people, but actually, if you look at the stark facts, it's kind of down to that. I think America spent $7.5 trillion on nuclear weapons since the initiation of the nuclear age. It may be $5 trillion, it may be $7.5. It matters little, really, but huge amounts. And and when you look at what we did, Hans, and you probably were involved in the nuclear weapons freeze in the 80s, where 80% of Americans wanted the Cold War to stop, wanted the weapons to be arrested on both the Russian and the American side, and many of us wanted reduction in nuclear weapons. In fact, quite a few wanted abolition.
Yeah.
Now we are in the year, what year are we? 2011. Nothing, when you look at it, nothing has changed. And I could use a rude Australian expression here, nothing bloody well has changed. Let's talk about the number of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert on the American side, and then we'll get to the Russian side. How many? on what systems are they deployed,
mm-hmm.
and what does it really mean, hair trigger alert? I want you in a nice, concise, proceed way to explain to the audience and arouse their fear. I want them to know exactly how things currently stand in our hands.
Well, let's see. On the American side, there are two chunks of two parts of the nuclear weapons arsenal where you have forces that are on alert. One, the most important one, I guess, is the land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, where the United States currently has 450 of these in silos in the Midwest. And something in the order of 95 to 98% of them are on high alert. That means that they are ready at any given time to launch within about 4 to 5 minutes after receiving the launch order from the president.
And tell me, how many hydrogen bombs are on each of these over 400 missiles?
Well, they are nearly all downloaded to one.
Just
there are
one?
A few of them that still have multiple warheads on them. But the United States has, by and large, moved away from having a lot of warheads on each missile on land. It has moved towards having one warhead. Quite done with that process. It'll take another few years.
Well, of the over 400, how many still have multiple warheads?
About 25 or so.
And those multiple warheads, probably there are three of them, right, on each missile?
There are 2 to 3 of them, yes.
And how big, we say warhead, how big are these hydrogen bombs, both the ones on single ones on missiles and the ones with three on each missile? How large are they compared to the Hiroshima bomb?
Right. They go up to about 300 kilotons, which is in the order of, 20 times the Hiroshima bomb. So these are significant weapons, obviously,
significant.
By any standard.
Yeah.
And but that's what we have on the land side, if
okay.
you will. The U.S. also has 14 ballistic missile submarines, Trident submarines, each armed with 24 long-range ballistic missiles. They can carry and do carry multiple warheads.
How many each?
We estimate that normally each carries an average of four.
Four.
And they range in yield. There are two types of warheads that are deployed on them. The most common one is about 100 kiloton, and the most powerful one is about 455 kiloton.
Which is how many times the Hiroshima bomb?
Which is about, 40 times? It's an enormous power that's specifically for that latter part designed to dig up essentially Russian underground facilities.
They're penetrating bombs.
It is not necessarily a penetrating bomb or warhead. It is it's one that you bring to explode either on the surface or the optimum height of burst. And depending on the height, it'll dig up essentially with literally shock waves. It'll devastate any facility that's underground. But it's an enormously dirty form of targeting because it means there are colossal amounts of radioactive fallout that's going to be sucked up into the atmosphere, it's going to obviously be carried away with the wind and fall over people. So it's a very dirty form of targeting, if you will. Now, of those submarines that are at sea, or of these 14 submarines, it's not all of them that are on alert at any given time. In fact, most of them are sort of shuttling back and forth from their deployment areas. And it's assumed that altogether about four of those submarines, two in the Atlantic, two in the Pacific, are on alert, ready to launch their missiles. And they can do so within 12 to 15 minutes after receiving a launch order from the president. So altogether, the land and the sea base, in the case of the United States, there is something in the order of about 800 to 900 warheads on alert at any given time. Now, this is out of a total inventory that the Department of Defense has, counting all kinds of warheads, of about 5,000 warheads that are currently remaining in the U.S. military's inventory today.
But are those? Does that include those in storage?
It includes those in storage.
I thought including in storage, it's up to 9,000.
No, that's if you include weapons that have been officially retired from the Department of Defense.
Yeah, but they're in cupboards and stuff.
Well, yeah, but they're not. They're not. They're in line for being dismantled.
Yeah, but they could pull them out and use them if they wanted to.
If they want, they're still intact weapons. Yeah, they could be pulled back if they needed to, but they're not considered part of that part of it, and they're on their way out.
Well,
but anyway, the point is that the stockpile that the military has a possession over is about 5,000 today.
Okay, so now I want you, Hans Christensen, from the Federation of American Scientists, to describe to the audience exactly how a nuclear war could start. Tell us what would initiate the signal, what would, and then all the dynamics that take place and within what period of time.
Well, as you can imagine, it very much depends on the circumstances.
Yeah.
Right now, in this day and age, it's not like during the Cold War where the United States and the Soviet Union had thousands of nuclear weapons out there deployed, ready to go. Of course, as you just heard, there's still quite a number of weapons that are not off alert yet. But compared to the Cold War, it is a big change.
Well, let's talk about the 900 on alert.
That's on the U.S. side.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And what could initiate, what circumstance could initiate their use, and how long does it take, and what are all the dynamics and communications that would happen?
Well, the U.S. would, at least according to its doctrine, consider the use of its nuclear weapons if some other country used weapons of mass destruction against the United States or its troops, its allies, or its friends.
You mean just conventional weapons?
Conventional, even conventional, chemical, biological,
nuclear. Oh, so they're going to use nuclear weapons against countries that do not have nuclear weapons?
Yes.
There are several countries. Yeah, that's right. That's North Korea.
North Korea might have some, but we don't know how far they've gotten, really.
We don't know.
Countries like Iran that does not have nuclear weapons yet, and Syria that does not have nuclear weapons, those countries are also in the crosshairs.
That's obscene.
Well, I mean,
it is. It
you,
is
and I, you and I may agree on that.
No, but it is from a humanitarian point of view and a moral point of view. That's obscene that you would use weapons on Syria, which has no nuclear weapons, and murder, and incinerate millions of people.
Well, yes. I mean, it wouldn't happen out of the blue. It would happen in response to them attacking the United States or its allies first.
Like blowing up the World Trade Towers and they would incinerate millions of people?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly. I mean, it's all sorts of vague scenarios,
vague,
of course.
Yeah.
But the point just is that you would have to have really dire circumstances before I think anybody, would consider pressing the nuclear button on this side. But that's just to say that the kind of threat scenario that we're in today is really completely, completely different from during the Cold War. Yet, many of the principles for the nuclear weapons, the planning, many of the elements of the posture, like I mentioned, with the numbers, high numbers of weapons that are on alert, have only changed, marginally to the point where it's really sort of a remnant of a Cold War posture we have today, even though that is not the world we anymore live in.
Well, I think I beg to disagree with you, Hans, because let's be frank, Russia still has over 1,000 hydrogen bombs on head trigger alert too. And as you well know, the Russian early warning system, including their early warning satellites, is really dilapidated and degraded. They may have some over-the-horizon radar systems which could detect weapons coming, number one. Number two, they're ready to go like yours are. Number three, Russia and America own 97% of the nuclear weapons in the world today. And number four, they still target each other. It is true. I know that in the PSYOP plan, America targets Russia and it targets China. Russia targets America. Europe and you know, Canada and Australia and the like. So the truth is, in the PSYOP plan, although this new nuclear posture of you might say that we're only going to look at, you know, Syria and Korea, North Korea and the like, weapons of mass destruction, the truth is, underlying this new nuclear posture of you is still the fact that Russia and America could initiate a nuclear global holocaust by accident, by design, by hackers hacking into the early warning system in the Pentagon or in the Kremlin, by people making mistakes. People are fallible. So what I don't understand, Hans, is why this is not talked about in the nuclear posture review.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it is in a way talked about, but in the way that you can imagine, it says, we are mindful about these situations, but we think it's better to keep it to keep our current posture, if you will. That is safer for the kind of situation we can envision might happen in the future. That's what they say. I mean, I don't agree with it.
Well, what's the current posture? What's the current, what I just described?
Well, one decision, I mean, a couple of major decisions that the Nuclear Posture Review made. One was that the United States will retain a triad of long-range strategic weapons, which is three legs, if you will, three modes of deployment for its long-range strategic nuclear warheads, one being the land-based ICBMs I talked about, the other being the sea-based ballistic missile submarines, and the third leg being long-range bombers. This is a Cold War posture.
And it will be maintained.
It'll be maintained. It'll be modernized. It is supposed to be here, at least for the foreseeable future. That's one major decision. The other major decision was that the United States will maintain the current readiness level of its nuclear weapons. In other words, it will keep nuclear forces on high alert. It will not de-alert. It might, they do talk about this, come up with ways to, if you will, lengthen the time a president has to make a decision.
Instead
in any
of
given
3 minutes, he's got 3 minutes at the moment.
Yes, so they recognize that there might be a problem there. And so they're going to come up over the next several years here with ways to try to lengthen the decision time where he will have to order the button to be pressed.
Okay, now let's go to the realistic, probable, pragmatic scenario. Here's Russia with over 1,000 hydrogen bombs ready to go, targeting, I mean, I wrote an article with Bob McNamara about this. At the moment, there are probably 40 H-bombs targeted on New York City from Russia, 60 on Washington, D.C. In other words, there are multiple hydrogen bombs targeted on major cities and, you know, lots of smaller cities across the United States. The Russians, their technology, I know from experience, isn't always spot on, not nearly as sort of pragmatic and carefully orchestrated as the Americans. And say they made a mistake or as in 1995, a missile was launched from Norway carrying a weather satellite, but the Russians had been told that this was going to happen, but the Kremlin lost the data. They got all confused. They saw the missile going off. They thought, oh, my God, America's launched an attack from a Trident submarine near Norway. They went on a nuclear alert, and Yeltsin, who was a hardened alcoholic, had 3 minutes to decide whether or not to launch their arsenal towards the United States. And they were very confused, and the generals were encouraging him to press his button. And a few seconds before the end of that 3 minutes elapsed, the missile veered off course, and that's why we're still here. Now, that sort of scenario is not uncommon. Not uncommon, because computers make mistakes, satellites make mistakes, humans make mistakes, and in this case it was a human error, like induced Three Mile Island, like induced Chernobyl, human errors. And so I want you, Hans Christensen, to walk us through the scenario where Russia thinks they're under attack. Maybe a flock of geese has set off their early warning system, or a rising moon, or, you know, those things do set off the satellites. How would it proceed and what would then happen? And how long do people have to make decisions? And then what would happen? This is really what could happen.
Well, I mean, you already described the one potential or one possible opening stage of that situation with a misunderstood signal from a launch of something that was not an actual nuclear attack, and how the system goes, essentially overboard and makes decisions that are crazy.
Mm.
But, you know, it can come from any kind of, I mean, you know, these kind of scenarios, accidents or misunderstandings, obviously have a nasty way of happening in ways that people do not foresee.
Or predict, yes.
Or predict. And this is always the dilemma. And therefore, I think the primary goal is to try to reduce the forces and the way they're operated in such a way that if something goes wrong, we don't have the unfortunate consequence that a continent lays barren as a result of it. And so,
but it won't be one continent; it'll be two continents.
Of course.
But walk us through. Just
there will be a retaliation.
Yeah, I want you to walk us through. Say Russia did make a mistake, and they thought, you know, that America had launched a first strike attack, and you know, was going to knock out a decapitation strike, knock out Moscow and Putin. How would the thing proceed? And give us the time scenarios, Hans.
Well, the first thing that would happen if the Russian president had decided that this was, in fact, an attack, it was a limited attack, he would most likely have concluded in that particular scenario you mentioned that this was an attempt where they used just one or a few missiles to go and take out a central command and control facility somewhere so that they knock down the door, so to speak, or blind them or something like that, and you can have the real attack coming right after.
Yeah.
And in response to that kind of scenario, you can imagine that what they would want to do is either do something similar, take out some eyes and ears of the other side first, in order to prevent them from having an advantage.
Well,
you
say eyes and ears, you're talking military strategy. What do you actually mean? Washington, New York, what?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, it can be command and control centers. It can be radar stations that are central to being able to see how a nuclear war unfolds, so to speak.
In the passion and the fear and the anger of Moscow being attacked, I hardly think they're going to think logically and rationally like that.
Well, it might be. Before you get to the big strike, so to speak, you probably will see a number of those more limited strikes at first to see where things are heading, so to speak. But as you indicate, I mean, this is kind of one of those crazy hopes and dreams and aspirations that some people have, that they think it's possible to control escalation once it gets to this stage. And I think that either country would, of course, assume the worst.
They'd go Burko, yeah.
Well, they might, yeah.
Oh, they would.
There is certainly that danger, no doubt about it. But this just underscores why it is so essential that people move away from postures that make these kind of mistakes possible from escalating into something much worse.
But then what people need to know is, look, if Russia mistakens an attack by America, this is just a hypothetical scenario because it could happen bilaterally. So Putin presses the button, right? Their missiles come out of their missile silos and headed towards America. Their missiles have got multiple hydrogen bombs on them, each independently targeted. And their missiles and bombs take only half an hour to go from where to go, from Russia to all the multiple targets in America. In that time, America picks up the attack, and during that half an hour, they press their button and off go 900 hydrogen bombs towards Russia and or China. And so the whole thing is over within about an hour. But as the weapons are coming towards Washington, First, they're picked up by America's radars and satellites. Then the message is sent back to Central Command in Omaha, Nebraska. And then it is communicated to the White House after a little session with the Joint Chiefs to say, is this really happening or not? And the president, be it Obama, has 3 minutes decision time then to decide what to do. And because there's a man always walking behind him with the football containing the codes for nuclear war, he has 3 minutes with his football to decide. And they're not whether to press the button or not. It's there are three possibilities. One is counter force, which two is to target your missiles on their missile silos, which will be too late anyway because you're under attack. Two is counter value targeting cities and people, or the third is, I think, a combination. But the three possibilities the president has does not include not doing it. And then the thing's over in about an hour, and that's the end of life on the planet.
Well, in that extreme case, of course, yeah. Absolutely.
Go on.
No, what I'm saying is that, of course, that is the extreme scenario where everything goes wrong and everybody makes the robotic decision that you would expect them to do if the worst case happened, of course.
But the men in the missile silos are trained. They're 18 to 21, and they're trained, yes, sir, no, sir, press the button, sir, Pavlovian dog responses. They are absolutely trained to do that. And once, if you only have to look at Fukushima, Hans, to build 5, 6 nuclear power plants on an earthquake fault sets a scenario of stupidity for the catastrophe which is currently ongoing in Japan. We have now thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. The scenario is set for, and it's stupid to have done that, but the scenario is set for a nuclear global holocaust. And although the nuclear posture of view sounds all very well and good and will only target little countries with, chemical weapons or whatever, the truth is that underlying this nuclear posture of view is this, I don't have an adjective for it, this scenario whereby by human error, by computer abnormality, by a satellite misinterpreting a flock of geese or a rising moon as a nuclear attack, we're all dead. And that scenario, the truth is, Hans, has not changed since 1980, since 19, it's still the same. It's still there, even though there's a sort of, it's like icing on a cake or embroidery. It's all sounds much better. See, the Nuclear Posture Review says, reverse the nuclear ambitions of North Korea and Iran. We don't even know if Iran's got them. Strengthen the international atomic energy safeguards so that people who get nuclear power plants don't make weapons. Create consequences of non-compliance, whatever the hell that means. Impede sensitive nuclear trade. What does that mean? Well, you're not allowed to get fissile material if you're a non-nuclear nation. Promote peaceful use of nuclear energy without increasing proliferation risks, which you cannot do. Locking down nuclear materials in 4 years, which you actually can't do. Fissile material cutoff and comprehensive test ban. None of those mean a thing compared to the scenario I've just described and the fact that 97% of the hydrogen bombs in the world belong to Russia and America. And nothing has changed since the Cold War ended. Oh, yeah, they've got rid of a few of them. Yeah, they've decommissioned a few of them. They haven't got quite as many, but as we know, Hans, you only need 1,000 bombs dropping on 100 cities to create nuclear winter and the end of most life on Earth. And that data has not changed, and it remains so. And so if both Russia and America go for it, we've got nuclear winter.
Yep, I'm not arguing with that.
But see, what you're a lovely guy, and you're highly intelligent, and I read your stuff all the time because you're so absolutely reliable. But there's a sort of psychosis in Washington and in the military and in the White House where you have all these really nice statements and it sounds like motherhood and apple pie and everything's okay, nuclear posture review, reverse the nuclear ambitions of North Korea and Iran. But the major pathology, it's like treating a patient dying of cancer, treating a pimple on their nose.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm not arguing with you that this is a ridiculous situation or anything like that. Not at all. I mean, I think it is, and I think just urging that, you know, maybe there are ways that people can think about perhaps how to break some of this cycle, if you will. But of course, that's a hard it's a hard sell if there's not enough, if you will, widespread focus on this.
It's a hard sell if, in fact, the media is not attending to it, A. B, if, in fact, people in the know are not actually talking about reality and the truth. You know, when I got to know Bob McNamara towards the end of his life, who was Jack Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, he was in the Oval Office during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in fact, in the WikiLeaks documents that have just been released, they say that America came close, very close to nuclear war. But he looked at me and he said, "Helen, you don't know how close we came." He said, "Within minutes of having a nuclear war with Russia." And the fact is that a lot of this material that we need to know, because it happens to be our world and our lives and 30 million other species cohabiting the planet with us, you know, it's classified as secret. And I have to tell you, how dare they classify our lives and our babies' lives and the future of life on Earth as secret? Who do they think they are to have set themselves up as the magicians and Merlins controlling maybe the only life in the universe? Now, I'm socking it to you, Hans, but I'm not meaning to be personal at all. All I'm doing, I guess, is having a catharsis. because having been deeply involved in this for so many years, I see it so aberrantly going off in the wrong direction, on the wrong tangent, Hans. Would you like to talk about that a little?
Well, I mean, your reaction, of course, is what you hear normally. I mean, you hear two kinds of reaction overall. I mean, there are people who sort of don't really care or think about it, and there are others who really think it's the most insane thing that you can possibly think of.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the debate tends to fall into either of those two, if you will. And then there are all these conversations, as you sort of alluded to, going on about this, the fine words and the nice sentences and what have you.
Cocktail parties at the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, anyway, I mean, you have these, you know, I live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And let me tell you about the sort of endless barrage of yet another conference and another meeting where we talk about these things. And but, you know, there is some sort of a surreal reality about it, because at the end of the day, it's very little, as you say, that changes. And it takes many presidents and it takes many decades to sort of just pry a little more open of this. Of this kind of madness, if you will. So that's the frustrating reality of it. But hey, anybody who has some sort of magic potion that can punch through that, I'd be happy to hear. That's for sure. But
let me ask
you. It's really a tough one to sell.
Let me ask you a personal question, Hans. You're so intelligent and you're so right in the middle of it, and know all the data. What drives you?
Well, I, like yourself, sort of, you know, very much got involved in this kind of business back in the 1980s and sort of, you know, was part of the, I grew up in Europe. I was part of the the peace movement over there. And we
were in Germany?
In Denmark.
Denmark, yep.
But we had the front there between the Cold War front going right down in the middle of Europe. And if something would happen, it would most likely happen there. And it was a huge, of course, political and emotional issue dominating everything, of course, at the time. And so that's when I got involved in it. And, of course, it was nothing more than a gut feeling of this being ridiculous and outrageous and you got to do something about it. I mean, that's what it was. And so today it still is. And it, you know, what drives me, of course, is to try to, you know, finish the job.
Yeah.
But that is a long, long process, unfortunately. But it is one where, you know, cynical as the situation is, and it's certainly not been resolved in any shape or form to the point that I think people had hoped 2 decades ago when the Cold War ended. What we're seeing now is more that some of that ambition, if you will, that window that was open for a long time, it's not, if not necessarily closing, but it's certainly that the gap is much, much narrower these days. So on the one hand, you have the contrast between a new U.S. president that talks about the ambition of going to zero, and you have a really over the last 3 or 4 years sort of an international community that has been very much galvanized and sort of jumped on this potential opportunity. And then you have a nuclear policy review that comes out that really sort of seems to basically put a foot in the door and say, fine, guys, we're going to have reductions and we're going to have, you know, reducing the role, so to speak. But really, we're going to be fiddling here with the margins. And by and large, I mean, they're going to invest $213 billion in modernizing the nuclear
forces. Okay, I want you to address that. I want you to address modernization. What the hell does it mean, and how much money they're spending, and how did this happen, and what are the factories they're going to use, and what weapons are they going to build? I love that word modernization. It's yep. a euphemism. It likes like we had to destroy the village to save it, sort of thing. So, just describe this quotes modernization of nuclear weapons, Hans.
Well. It is a very wide range of beefing up, essentially, the capabilities of the both the systems you have, but also the production capabilities. We have modernization, so to speak, happening on three fronts. One is the delivery vehicles. They have made a commitment, and they're in the process right now of designing the next generation of ballistic missile submarines that come in.
Submarines? They're going to build more submarines?
A new class, yeah.
Oh,
not more.
God. But
there'll be a new class that'll replace the old one.
Yeah, and, well, that's more.
Well, it's not going to be a bigger fleet once it's done, but it'll be a big fleet, nonetheless, about 12 of them.
Good
so they'll
God.
Slice two off that at that force. So that's on one level where they also have committed to building a long-range bomber, in some shape or form, with a cruise missile, nuclear cruise missile, if Congress will fund it, as well as a future land-based ballistic missile replacement. So that's on the delivery system.
So let me just summarize. New nuclear weapons submarines, new land-based ballistic missiles, and new bombers.
Correct.
Who's building them?
Who's building them?
Lockheed Martin, Boeing, who are building them?
No, the subs are being built by
General Dynamics.
Newport News, Newport News, the shipyards.
Yeah. The planes.
The missiles, the Trident missiles built by Lockheed Martin.
Yeah.
The ICBMs are built by what are they? It's a consortium of different contractors now. It's not the same way that it was in the past.
Yeah.
It's an abbreviation. I'm sorry, I can't remember it.
It's all right.
But anyway, the point is that there is a modernization on the delivery systems that at least the administration has committed to. Then there's also what's known as life extension programs of the warheads that they carry.
The hydrogen bombs.
They have decided. Say what?
A warhead is a hydrogen bomb. Yeah,
correct.
Yep.
Yeah. All the warheads that are currently in the Department of Defense stockpile are slated to go through a very expensive life extension process where they extend their lives with another 30 years. So they come in, they get overhauled, and as you can imagine, once the nuclear laboratories get to fiddle with them, they begin to add, you know, bells and whistles and you know, fiddle with the weapons to get better capability into the existing weapons.
To kill more people.
Well, yeah. To be more efficient at what they want
to
do.
To kill more people. Yeah. Well, that's what and they
then,
do.
And then you have the third category, which is the production facilities, the factories that can build these bombs, where they're building two enormously expensive factories right now, one at Los Alamos and one at Oak Ridge. And the combined price of these two factories alone may reach $12 billion.
And one at Kansas City.
There is a Kansas City plant as well, which is for non-nuclear components for the nuclear weapons. So you have a modernization of all these three elements, the major components of the U.S. nuclear enterprise, as they call it, where over the it's a commitment to extending the nuclear age as far into the future as it has lasted so far.
Did this happen with a president who stood up in Prague and said he wants to eliminate nuclear weapons? How on earth did this...
Well, it happened because he said two things in Prague.
Yeah.
He said, one, he wants to reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons and the role, and by doing that, put an end to Cold War thinking, as he said. But he also promised another thing, which is that as long as nuclear weapons exist, we will continue to modernize the ones we think are necessary to retain.
Did he say that in Prague?
Absolutely.
I missed that.
No, but the point here is that what we have is not, you know, if you will, a disarmament administration. It is an administration that has a schizophrenic nuclear policy that, on the one hand, it speaks highly of the importance of reducing the numbers and the role, but on the other hand, it commits billions of dollars to modernize and extending the nuclear era. So it's really kind of hard to see where the focus is, if you will.
It's schizophrenic. There's a split between reality and perception of reality. I have to say, you know, it's evil. Because, it is because you got into it, Hans, because you were scared. And I'm scared still, but everyone should be scared, number one. Number two, nobody really knows about this because of the euphemistic language that is used to disguise exactly what they're doing. Number three, there's a team of scientists called the Jasons who inspect nuclear weapons. And some years ago they did a study which said that all the hydrogen bombs in the stockpile today could still work perfectly for the next 100 years. There's no need to modernize, upgrade, make sure they're reliable or whatever. Number four, the corporations have their nose in the pig trough of the taxpayers' money. And while America's going down the chute, you know, double dip, recession, the whole thing, there are still these corporations, and the way they do it is say it's for national security and national defense, and it's all in the name of nationalism. How are we going to break through this curtain?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the one of the areas where you might see some reaction, of course, is that if you look across the board, the United States, Russia, China, France, and Britain, and for sure also Pakistan, India, they're all busy modernizing.
Are they? Are they all modernizing?
All of them.
Is that
and
so?
And so introducing new weapon systems or upgraded weapon systems or what have you, none of them, zero, are in any way acting as if they have decided now to take, you know, the real steps where you can see, aha, the end is down here. That's our end goal. This is still sort of a dream or an ambition or, you know, a policy vision, if you will. And there are people, I mean, I got to hand it to, you know, there are people in the administration that are trying.
Who?
They see this
John
as a
Holdren?
Problem. Right. Well, you know, I mean, he's not right in that camp, but he certainly... one of the kind of characters that would have been trying. But there are other people that are really trying to break some of this cycle.
Biden.
But they are up against some significant forces that are trying to drag their heels and draw a line in the sand.
Tell me then...
And so what I'm getting to here is that I think that to achieve these non-proliferation objectives that you listed a number of them just earlier in the interview, for the Obama administration, to achieve these non-proliferation initiatives and strengthening the international non-proliferation regime and all these things. That is only going to happen if the United States can get support from a large number of other countries that do not have nuclear weapons. And they are, you know, obviously signatories to the non-proliferation treaty. What I'm getting to here is that there's no way these things are going to change unless there's a political price for continuing business as usual. And so this is only really going to change if it begins to hurt politically to have a schizophrenic nuclear policy, if you will, that you give defiant speeches in public, and then you come home and you sign some more contracts and you continue to essentially extend the nuclear era into the future, nonetheless. So,
are you
so whether we're going to see those kind of political effects happening internationally, who knows? I mean, there are many other things that are going to play in, but I don't think there's any doubt that there will be an increasing number of countries within the next decade that are going to be asking some very frustrated questions about these issues. And, you know, in the worst of circumstances, some of them in the future might decide that it's no longer really worthwhile for them to be members of the non-proliferation treaty.
Well, see, I see it as, you know, America is so hypocritical. We're the ones with nuclear weapons. We're the most powerful. And what's more, the best country in the world? How dare they? I mean, you know, they haven't even got any kangaroos. I'm being facetious.
Working on that.
You're working on it. Are you from the mutations? Anyway.
Exactly.
No, but, and you see, other countries look at America and France and Britain and say, you've got nuclear weapons? We'll have them too. The only way to prevent proliferation of nuclear weapons where non-nuclear nations develop nuclear weapons from their nuclear power plants is for Russia, America, Britain, China, India, Pakistan, France, say, we're going to disarm. There's no other way. There's no other way, knowing the psychology of men and maybe some women. Isn't that true? Would you agree with that, Hans?
Yeah, I think there has to be a very, very clear commitment that that is the goal and the timeline for how to get there.
Yeah.
And unless countries begin to see that clear commitment, they're not going to buy all these fine talks about we're just going to fiddle around with this for another five decades and trust us. In the end, we really want to go there.
By then, we probably will have blown up the world. Now, I've got a hypothetical question for you, Hans Christensen. Okay, so you're the president. What? No, this is serious. What are you going to do? I want your plan right now, after our discussion. What is your plan? And you know enough to be able to have a plan. You know as much as the president.
Well, if I were the president.
Yes, if I were the president.
Well, first of all, I would stop modernization programs.
Okay,
absolutely,
number one.
And make sure that what the laboratories were doing, that what the agencies were doing, were nothing but maintaining the bolts and screws, make sure things didn't fall apart tomorrow, but not modernize in any shape or form.
Okay, number one. That's no modernization. One. Yep, two.
Secondly, I would say I would go in and I would fundamentally change the president's guidance for what it is he tells the military they're supposed to plan for when it comes to nuclear weapons. That guidance from him needs to be changed.
To 100%.
What? I would order them to completely move out of sort of war fighting scenario planning, if you will, where you use nuclear weapons to hunt down nuclear weapons in these strike scenarios, where you have excessive targeting strategies with you know, requiring thousands of weapons as we have today. I would want that kind of targeting policy to come down to something very basic. We put out a report just 3 years ago, which we called From Counterforce to Minimal Targeting, where we advocate moving out of this kind of nuclear warfighting planning and creating as a stepping stone toward a world where you can actually think about what does it mean to go to zero. Because we haven't honestly started to think about that yet, as far as I can see.
Yeah, okay. Three?
So that was those would be my two major components of doing this. And then, of course, you cannot do this. unless you get the other nuclear weapon states on board.
But you'll get them on board by becoming the leader and showing them how and demonstrating, and they will then be cowed and embarrassed, and they will follow. The media is not covering this at all. And, you know, let's be frank, a fellow countryman of mine really, you know, broadcasts to two-thirds of the world's population and is incredibly powerful. And he
absolutely.
He will not touch this with a 10-foot pole.
And you know what? I mean, it takes one rich person, just one rich person.
To do what?
To put down the money into a foundation that will fund this type of work, and they can do it. But it's not being done. There are a few sort of small organizations that, do it. I want to mention one, Plowshares Fund here in the United States, which is has done a tremendous work, and both getting more money to do this kind of stuff, but also getting more money out to people to do it. And so that is really a positive development. But by and large, the big ones that used to do this back in the old days, the W. Alton Jones Foundation, increasingly also the MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, others, they're spending less and less and less and less money on this kind of work.
Well, on that really cheery note, Hans, we've run out of time. I thank you very much for this very edifying discussion, and I hope that everyone's gained from it in understanding where we're at. This is probably the most important discussion actually we've had on this program in the last 3 years. So I want everyone to take notice of this, and I thank Hans Christensen from the Federation of American Scientists so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thanks, Helen. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Hans. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Hans Christensen, Director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists in Washington, D.C. I want to make a very important announcement, and you all must listen very carefully. On October the 1st this year, there will be a large rally in New York at the Hudson River Parks Pier 95. Hudson River Parks Pier 95. It's a coalition against nukes. Call to action rally for a nuclear-free US. October the 1st, 2011. I will be speaking and many others will be speaking. This is a national day of rallies and events, the largest ever being held in New York City, with events happening simultaneously throughout the United States. October the 1st, Hudson River Parks Pier 95, 55th and 12th Avenue between 11:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. This is really only going to be about nuclear power plants a la Fukushima, Indian Point, and all the rest of them. However, it's intimately tied up with nuclear weapons in the program we had today. I want you all to come. I want you to bring your friends and your reluctant relatives, and we'll give them a really jazzy time. Anyway, thanks for listening today, and we'll be back with you again with another fascinating program next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.